I'm Daniel Atlin. Welcome to Messy, where I have conversations with leaders about how they navigate and make sense of the mess they find themselves in. Today on Messy, my guest is Duncan Iveson, President and Vice Chancellor of the University of Manchester. Duncan has great insight into the mess of leadership. He's lived and worked across Canada, the UK, and Australia. And that global experience, coupled with years leading and navigating complex public institutions, has shaped how he thinks about one of the defining challenges facing universities and other institutions today. How can you maintain public trust and remain relevant in a world being rapidly reshaped by technology, politics, and social change? As institutions confront declining trust, growing scrutiny, and the disruptive arrival of an artificial intelligence, Duncan argues that institutions can't simply defend the status quo. They have to engage openly with change, bringing communities along through dialogue and helping society think critically about the future it wants to build. Today, we'll explore the fragility of universities' social license, the tension between global reputation and public person, and the University of Manchester's approach to AI, and why disciplines like philosophy and the humanities may become more important than ever in a world increasingly mediated by technology. Welcome to Messy, Duncan.
Daniel, it's great to be with you. Great introduction, by the way.
Well, thanks so much. I'm enjoying these conversations that really get at the mess of leadership today, especially for these special organizations that I really like, the mission-based ones that are so important, but I think under threat more than they ever have been before. So I like to ask the same starting question of each guest, and it relates to a quote by Kierkegaard, that lives must be lived forwards, but can only be understood backwards. Do you want to maybe offer a higher level reflection on your origin story?
My story that began growing up in Montreal, in Quebec, in a very multicultural, bilingual environment, has shaped my career in so many ways, which I probably don't fully understand. But growing up in an environment where questions are being asked about identity, about culture, about power, about language, I can't help but think that that has shaped not only my academic interests, but my interests in universities and I guess in leadership roles more generally. I think the city really shaped me in all kinds of ways. And in a funny way, I'm only starting to realize that more recently in various ways.
That's fascinating. And it's great to hear as well, because we think of ourselves sometimes as static, right? And not evolving and things like that. But in reality, we're more like an onion or the different layers that we have. And the things we focus on are so important. Our pasts actually creep into the way we lead with our relationships as well. So it's so important.
What I've come to realize is, and this is probably a very romantic idea, but I think as a kid growing up, it was really only when I started to realize that ideas really matter, right? And I thought I'd become a lawyer and help solve the constitutional crisis of Canada. But literally within hours of being, you know, in McGill, I went to my first philosophy class and I just, fell in love with the subject. And I think on reflection, I've always really thought that ideas matter and they shape the world in ways that often I think aren't appreciated and requires us to think carefully about them because they matter. So I think ultimately that's probably where the origin story and the current career intersect in some way.
There's no question ideas matter, you know, now I think probably more than ever before as well. And we're going to get into, I think, a little bit later about AI and why the human element and ideas coming from a human actually matter far more than ever. But these days we're seeing ideas, whether they're positive or negative, having a huge influence on geopolitics and actually institutions as well. I've got to ask you to reflect a little bit about your own leadership journey, because you've actually moved across Canada, Australia, and now back to the UK. I'd like to sort of see if you can make sort of a little bit of a sense about that through line actually as well, and whether there's moments that you make sense of that time, and whether it's the same mess everywhere, or did you find things a little bit different in each different context?
on one level, it's kind of the same mess everywhere, to use your term, which is a really interesting one. I've enjoyed the new challenge of understanding those differences and thinking through those differences and making sense of the particularities of the particular mess that you find yourself in as an academic. I mean, I don't think there is a logic to my moves. I mean, other than the fact that my partner is Australian and we've always had this two-body problem of where we would end up, I think I've just been really fortunate to have extraordinary opportunities. And I guess we've been willing to take the leap and go for it. And like I said, I've been incredibly fortunate. I think of the institutions I've worked at, really interesting, wonderful institutions, each with their own challenges and problems, but also offering a really extraordinary set of opportunities for me to learn new things, you know, to grow as a person, to meet extraordinary people, and to get to do, you know, really fascinating things that matter. I've never had a career plan, but I sort of feel like each time I've moved, I've been able to sort of challenge myself in a new way that I wouldn't have if I hadn't done the thing I've been doing before. So there has been each role has sort of challenged me and stretched me and extended me in all kinds of ways. I've always been interested in the way that culture and organizations intersect. And so that's always meant I was curious about what it would be like to work in, whether it's Australia or Canada, or spend time in the States, you know, the UK. So I've always been really open to that. I've always found that a really fascinating intersection. That's probably been another thing. And, you know, there's a downside to that. You know, people who stay in organizations for their whole careers have a depth of insight and a kind of anchoring that is quite powerful. And that's, you know, I was in Sydney for almost 22 years, so I guess I've had that experience.
It's a big part of identity as well, I can imagine. And I guess for your family too, your children, your partner, your citizens of the world, I guess, or at least the Anglosphere in some ways, right? So
I have to say, my partner has been remarkably patient, although we've kind of, you know, you find ways to both accommodate and support each other in different stages in your life when it comes to these moves. And yeah, I think our kids have embraced it as well. I mean, we did stay in Sydney for most of their sort of their period of growing up. But now our son is in the States, our daughter's in Australia. So, you know, I think they're repeating the pattern.
Now, actually, come back to that, the word mess, actually. And it was actually an interesting sort of aha that I had when I was doing my research and interviews with university leaders a few years ago. And it was just that it seemed like actually calling out the mess actually was a pretty important thing for them, because it allowed them in some ways to be able to relax a little bit, to not try and control things as much. And it seemed to be able to be a little bit, you know, naming is actually a little bit of empowering and actually recognizing that it's a different world. So does that resonate with you as well?
No, it does. I mean, I think one of the things I've learned as I've taken on different roles with different levels of, I guess, responsibility is you've got to find a way to identify the things that really matter and just tune out the noise on the things that don't. And sometimes you get that wrong. Sometimes you should have turned the volume up and tuned down something else. But that really comes with, I think, experience and reflection. It's not something I did well early in my career, when you feel you have to solve everything, do everything, take on everything. And, you know, that's just impossible. Because, you know, it's something I was talking about with a colleague the other day. There's a sense sometimes that you're being promoted or you're moving into more senior roles because of your domain expertise or knowledge. It's the opposite. The more you climb, I guess, the organizational ladder, the less you know about things, and the more dependent you are, and the more curious you have to be on others and about others. And so it is messy. I've been thinking about this today in thinking about this chat we're having. You know, messy is a really interesting word, because it is a matter of just trying to identify the things that really matter for the organization, given the responsibility of the role that you're in, and being able to, amongst the mess, kind of identify that. And the leaders and people I've worked with who I really learned the most from and admire the most just had an innate ability to do that. And, you know, to know when to roll up your sleeves and dive in and really get stuck into the mess and to know when just to step back and stand back and let others do their thing. So I think it's a really interesting way of characterizing some of the challenges of leadership.
You're right, though. It is very different than what you were brought up to be, I guess, an academic. It's in some ways, very narrow expert in an area, but in some ways you become a generalist, you know, because you got to know a little bit about everything, right?
It is amazing how many people think, you know, I kind of love it because, you know, I'll walk into a laboratory or something and someone will say, well, of course, Duncan, you understand the basics of quantum mechanics. And I'm like, no, I think you need to explain that to me, you know, or whatever it is, right? And so I love that. I mean, that is one of the joys of working at a university is that every day, almost every single hour, I'm learning something really cool that I didn't know before. And I love that. But at the same time, you know, you've got to make sure you're also identifying and focusing on the things that really matter for the organization. And that is something that you really is a skill, is something you need to work at. And you need help to make sense of it as well.
Absolutely. You need the need to help. And you know, you need to recognize that you're going to make some flubs. You're going to actually, you know, have some mistakes, but that's okay. That's part of actually leadership as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Your discipline is philosophy, and I actually have a minor in philosophy as well as political science and an undergraduate level from many years ago. Why do you think that has prepared you well for actually leading the University of Manchester? And what does philosophy matter now when the world seems to be moving more technical towards AI-mediated solutions, et cetera?
Well, two big questions. So let me try and take them in turn. I mean, other people will have to judge if I'm leading them at University of Manchester well, so I'll put that aside for now. I have been surprised at how well my disciplinary training has prepared me, especially for this role, but also for, you know, I was a kind of deputy vice chancellor for research, and I was a dean, head of school, etc. And it's always been really a pleasant surprise to me how useful my philosophical training, and I did political science as well, like you, has prepared me for these roles. And I think there's two kind of general reasons why I think it does. The first is that ultimately, philosophy is in many ways about understanding the limits of your knowledge. It's about understanding what you don't know and being clear about what you have, as it were, a warrant to believe. That turns out to be an incredibly powerful tool for someone who's in a leadership organization like a university where there's so much information coming at you. There are so many different stakeholders, so many different things that you're trying to make sense of across teaching, research, partnerships, you know, the organizational structures, finance, all that stuff. And the discipline in philosophy of being clear about what the limits of your knowledge are is incredibly useful. And I think that leads to a related thing that philosophy prepares you very well for, which is how to ask good questions. I think the two are connected. So I think that's been a really useful set of skills for me that I hadn't really reflected on until relatively recently. My management gurus are Aristotle and Kant and John Rawls and Michel Foucault, rather than the traditional business school. Not that there's anything wrong with traditional business schools. I think the second reason philosophy has been such a useful set of skills in retrospect is that foundational first principles thinking is really important. The more senior, I guess, you get, if I can put it that way, because you want to make sure that the community you're a part of, the organization that you're helping to lead, is oriented around the right goals and values and is focused on the right things. And that requires a certain kind of way of, requires sort of robust first principles thinking. What really matters? What's our mission? And what follows from that in terms of then what we do to, you know, achieve our goals, to execute our strategy? And I think it turns out that, at least for me, that philosophical training on foundational first principles type thinking combined with that sort of humility about the limits of your knowledge is a good toolkit to start with as a leader. When you're making decisions about the organization, you know, about what to do and what your plans are and what your ambitions are, you're anchoring it in the right way, in the right values, in and you're asking the right questions about whether what you're doing is consistent with those values, and you're being robust about that and not sort of leaving it behind, as it were. And I think that then connects to the whole AI question. I mean, in a nutshell, as extraordinary as generative AI is, large language models don't think. Human beings think. And in an age of AI, the premium will be on thinking and imagination and creativity and human connection and perspective and judgment. And that is the wheelhouse of not just philosophy, but the humanities and arguably, you know, the natural and physical sciences and the other disciplines as well. But in an age of sort of transformational AI, it's human thinking and creativity and imagination and judgment that will matter most and as never before. And I do think that means, as much as we need brilliant computer scientists and engineers and machine learning folks, we need people asking the right kind of philosophical questions and ethical questions and value questions about the technology as never before, because that's not going to come from the tech industry. That's not going to come from the people building the machine. It's going to come from people who understand the machines, but are asking very different things of them. And so for me, it's an incredibly exciting time for philosophy. In fact, this weekend I was in Hong Kong with a whole bunch of philosophers and computer scientists, machine learning people, and government officials talking about how it might be possible to build cross-cultural frameworks for governing AI globally, as impossible as that sounds. And, you know, it was incredibly exciting. Like, this, some really interesting work is being done in the field. I think the young philosophers who were there, who were involved in this project, they're doing really interesting new work. And so I think it's an incredibly exciting time for people in the humanities to be leaning in and contributing to this debate about, you know, how we govern AI, how we regulate AI, how we think about the role of AI in our lives, which is, of course, unavoidable. But we still have choices to make about it. And we have choices about how we use it and deploy it and what we ask it to do. And it's really important that we remember that. So I think it's a great, so I think for that reason, philosophy and the social sciences, the humanities in general, it's really a golden era in many ways for these disciplines, despite the fact it might feel the opposite.
No, you're right. And I think, you know, I've spoken to, you know, a few vice chancellors now, and all of them are saying the same thing. Like, even those that don't come from, you know, that humanities, social science background, they're saying that these days, you know, what's really going to matter is actually that human element. And I think that the background you can have actually from those disciplines that actually are going to be so much more needed actually as technology further develops too. And I think maybe that's why, you know, going back to some of the older philosophers and some of that literature actually can be so important too.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, for Plato, writing was a technology that he thought would destroy our ability to remember things and therefore to be able to live a, you know, a good life or to be able to think in the way that he thought we needed to. So yeah, I mean, we can learn as much about technology sometimes from the ancient Greeks as we can from contemporary philosophers. So I think you're right.
Maybe moving to you know, more sort of local basis, and you're overseeing or stewarding the University of Manchester, which is one of the, you know, more complex institutions in the UK. It's one of the largest ones. It's a, you know, so broad and comprehensive and so important to the community as well. But at the same time, you actually have been one of the ones that I think have been really embracing AI and thinking about how to use it in different ways. Do you want me to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, you're right. I mean, we are, along with UCL, you know, one of the biggest institutions in the country, at least in terms of students and staff and, I guess, comprehensiveness. And that's really exciting. And that means we can do things that other universities can't. It also means sometimes it's harder for us to do things than other universities. So that's a challenge I really enjoy and welcome. But yeah, and we spent the last 12 months writing a new strategy, with the tagline of which is From Manchester for the World. And one of the core elements of that strategy is to sort of harness our scale and comprehensiveness in new and creative ways, both for the benefit of our students, for our staff, but also for the communities we serve. And a lot of that is about us also embracing technology, but in the right way. And this, interestingly, is a place that really is the birthplace of AI in many ways. This Manchester is the place where Alan Turing, the famous computer scientist, did his most foundational work on AI. The famous Turing test paper was written here when he was at Manchester. Interestingly enough, for the philosophy department at Manchester, this is where the first programmable computer was built, Baby, that enabled you to store, you know, data such that you could run a program. It's where the Manchester Code was created, which is, again, a foundational piece of technology that still shapes a lot of technology today. It's where the first supercomputer was built in the UK. So we have this incredible legacy, and we have a lot of strength in this domain. But we're also thinking about, you know, what do our students need to sort of not just survive in this point of the 21st century, but really flourish? And we feel that they need to have access to technology, but also the training and support to use it ethically and responsibly and creatively, and be aware of its limits and be aware of its problems, and to, in a sense, get stuck into the messiness, to borrow a term from you, around the technology. So we decided that, aligned with our strategy, we would basically find a way to make the technology available to everyone in our community for free, without restriction. And we struck a partnership with Microsoft, first of its kind, I think, in the world. So for now, I'm sure others will catch up, that sees all 65,000 people in our community get access to the latest, you know, version of Copilot. But at the same time, a whole range of training and support, and also a framework for testing, challenging, and debating the technology. So alongside of providing access to students and staff and faculty to use the technology, we've set up a whole series of working groups that are looking at the environmental impact of generative AI, the ethics and responsible use of generative AI, the way in which we might deploy it internally within the organization, and how we should do that. I see it as a kind of living natural experiment about how we can use this transformative technology in the right way. Because I don't think the tech companies are going to do it. I don't think governments are going to do it for us. I think we've got the opportunity to do it for ourselves. I think we have a responsibility, I think, to do it. The other thing is, we want our students to go out into the world with the appropriate kind of skills and capabilities, but also the right kind of ethical framework in a world that is going to be completely transformed by AI. I mean, I feel it would be irresponsible not to prepare our students for that world in this way. And increasingly, we feel that we need to pull into our undergraduate and postgraduate students' time with us the opportunities to do things that they might have done previously in their first job graduating from university. And that the labor market's being transformed in all kinds of ways, that I think we need to pull some of that experience that they would have got in their first job into their experience with us. And so that means, you know, we know employers want our students to have those AI competencies and skills, but they also want them to have those human skills as well. And that's really clear in the data and surveys and conversations we're having with employers, but also having with students and their families. Now, having said all that, it's been quite controversial, right? Which is, I kind of welcome. I mean, you know, the first town hall, I do regular town halls, and the first town hall I had after we announced the Microsoft partnership, I think we had 1,700 people, you know, rock up, and it ranged from this is evil and you're destroying the institution through to where's my license? So I, you know, so I can stop it. And I really welcome that because it is disruptive. It is discombobulating. It is challenging. We don't have all the answers. We don't know everything about the ultimate impact and consequences of this technology. But I believe strongly that it's at universities that we should be asking these questions and giving people the chance to challenge and deploy and use and experiment with this technology. So yeah, we've really kind of decided to go for it, lean into it, give people access, but also have the debate. And, you know, we were really clear. We wanted to make sure that it shouldn't depend on whether you buy it or you have to borrow a license off your friend. We also wanted to create a safe environment in which people can use the technology. So the beauty of the partnership with Microsoft is we have a really secure environment within which people can use the technology in all the appropriate ways and in all the ways that matter for an organization like us. So we're on our way, but it's, and, you know, I really welcome the debate and the conversation that's followed in the wake of it.
Well, and a little bit of dialogue and debate is certainly, you know, key to every decision you're making, I'm sure, and especially this one that has such a huge consequence as well. And but it's great that you're able to find an issue where you get 1,700 people interested in coming to a room, and actually that in itself is actually pretty good at a university. So, of course, these are complex roles, and you're never going to please everyone as well. And that's got to be one of the biggest challenges, I think, for any new university, you know, VC or president. It's actually dealing with that, right? The criticism, the personalization as well, because you're never going to get 100%. And if you get 100%, you're probably not doing anything, right?
What's that? I'm going to butcher it, but what's that? You know, what's that great Ed Koch? You remember Ed Koch, who was the mayor of New York City years and years ago? He had this line where he said, agree with me on 5 out of 10, vote for me. Agree with me on 10 out of 10, go see your psychiatrist. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's some grain of wisdom there. And it's certainly true in a university environment.
It certainly is. Others I've spoken to have said, you know, the challenge is, am I doing a good job? I don't know. And probably, you know, depends on who you're talking to as well. And whether my legacy will be remembered well will only be known afterwards as well, right? Because we're not in charge of those futures as well. So what's been one of the biggest learnings you've had, I guess, along this AI journey? Is there anything that, or I guess, you know, some things where you've had to sort of rethink things, go take a little bit of a side turn and do things a little bit differently?
Huge amount of learnings, because I think I underestimated the emotion about AI. I mean, I knew it was a big issue for all of us, but I think I underestimated or I've learned a lot about just how passionate people are about the risks of AI and the sense of not being in control of what the technology might do to us as an organization and to them as, you know, individuals, whether students or colleagues or partners. That was a real learning. You know, it was something that we probably should have anticipated, but, and it's been in a way a good process, but I was like, wow, we wanted to move fast because we had an opportunity and things are moving so fast. We didn't want to, you know, wait 18 months and have 100 committees. We decided to go for it. And what I learned was there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of emotion wrapped up in what the people feel this technology is doing to our culture, to our families, to our communities. Some good, but a lot bad. And, you know, so that was a good learning, I think, moment for me in particular. It made me really want to make sure we were listening and adapting and adjusting and you know, then adapting our engagement and our comms around this whole program of work in the appropriate way.
I imagine that engagement and dialogue is a huge part of this journey, actually, and creating forums that you can actually, you know, cultivate that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really important. You know, there's a concept in political philosophy called deliberated disagreement, and it sounds very hokey and very, you know, so liberal and everything, but I really believe in it. There's a big difference between when you and I disagree without actually talking to each other. We just make assumptions about each other's beliefs and say, oh, that guy's a jerk. There's a big difference between that and actually having a conversation. And we might still disagree just as passionately at the end of that conversation, but something has happened between us. There's been some recognition of, you know, between us. And I think that really matters in a university environment, which is suffused with disagreement. So in my experience, turning up and having the conversation, standing up at the front of the room or whatever and saying, okay, let's talk about this, doesn't solve every problem, doesn't mean people leave feeling the world is instead of right. But there's a big difference between doing that and not doing it and just saying, well, we disagree, so we just leave it at that. You can't do it for everything, but for the things that really matter, it's important.
Well, and there's that expression, I think it's tough on ideas, but not on the person, right? So absolutely, you know.
Yeah, I hate the idea, but not the person, yeah.
Which we need more of these days, I think, actually, especially in political quarters.
Do we ever? Yeah, do we ever?
So universities are an interesting institution. They're focusing on, really interesting communities that are all discipline related. There's more interdisciplinary than there ever has been, probably. But if you were to maybe think about, you know, how you could tinker with the model, and maybe, you know, if you were starting from scratch today, what would things that you'd be using to consider actually as we evolve?
I actually talked about it this weekend, this past weekend. Global governance conference. I mean, in a nutshell, universities, and certainly something where we're experimenting with here, but other institutions are doing it as well. I think we need to organize ourselves more around the problems and challenges that the world faces rather than expecting the world to organize itself around our disciplines. And it doesn't mean abandoning disciplines. It doesn't mean, because you need the depth and the robustness and the richness of disciplinary training and knowledge to do great science, to do great literature and philosophy and history. But I think the universities of the great universities of the 21st century are going to look and feel different in that sense. And moreover, they're going to give our students more of that opportunity to see problems and questions in the round and to have the skills to be able to do that more importantly. So, yeah, I guess if I was to wave a magic wand and say, let's refound the University of Manchester, I think we might have faculties that look very different and schools that look very different, and we'd be more porous in terms of the kinds of institutions, organizations we worked with. And our students would have a more porous kind of experience of their own learning. And I think increasingly our social license to operate will increasingly rely on us being able to organize ourselves in those ways. I think the community really respects the deep discovery research we do. They really respect the quality of the teaching that my colleagues do, but at the same time, they increasingly want the university to help figure stuff out that will make their lives better. And I know for some of my colleagues, that's like anathema, but I think it's something we need to really embrace and make sense of and start to organize ourselves around.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the word university makes it sound like it's one, you know, one monolithic institution too, and it's really, yeah. It's a collective, it's a complex adaptive system in a lot of ways, and you have so many different things that are happening in different areas of the institution, and some of which are innovations probably happening now that actually could be tinkered with and hopefully it someday will be accepted by others as well and change that culture too.
Exactly. Yeah, no, exactly. So it's how do you preserve the incredible creativity of institutions like universities, whilst at the same time bringing the community along with you and having them feel they've got a stake at what's happening in the institution and that they feel as though you are actually contributing to their lives going better. I think this is that's very abstract, but I think this is something that I see the really successful universities over these next few decades really getting right.
And increasingly, there seems to be more dialogue about, or maybe it's always been there, I'm just seeing it more, who knows, it could be my own bias, about universities maybe being breaking down a little bit of the model of the four-year or three-year undergraduate degree.
I think university education is going to become more distributed, more extended, much more about lifelong learning rather than just the 18 to 24-year-old. And there's some amazing emergent examples of that across the world that, you know, we certainly are paying attention to and that we're thinking hard about. You know, in our strategy, we talk about, you know, flexible learning becoming the model for us, the norm for us. And that doesn't mean walking away from undergraduate degrees or postgraduate degrees or PhDs, but it does mean experimenting and being much more flexible and adaptable across time and space, if I can put it that way. And that's a big challenge for a university like Manchester, which has been wildly successful as a kind of traditional comprehensive university. But I think unless we adapt, we will quickly find ourselves in all kinds of trouble. And more interestingly and importantly, we'll miss the opportunity to really learn new things and meet people where they are and meet the community in terms of what kind of learning, what kind of education they increasingly will want. That's a big theme for us at the moment.
Well, and it's an important theme as well. Status quo, you know, has never been really, really, you know, acceptable anywhere because it doesn't even really exist anymore because to be able to be the status quo requires too much work, actually. So we have to actually be able to change. But maybe turning to a more personal sort of question is about how you sort of, you know, get through your complex role as well, and maybe a little bit about self as instrument type of work. You know, we have a surplus of data and plausible directions and the tyranny of urgent these days. How you make your decisions when you're in the middle of a mess and competing demands and priorities, and, you know, what's the approach you use?
I mean, the first thing is, although, you know, the buck stops with you when you're in these roles, and you always need to remember that, you have to focus on your team. You have to build a great team. And I certainly made lots of rookie mistakes in various roles in the past where I didn't really understand that. I didn't really understand that profoundly enough. So the first thing is, you need to build a team. You need to be in a situation where you're making decisions collectively and you're drawing on the talents and expertise of the people around the table, around the organization that can help you get to the right answer and get to the right decision. So I think for me, the first thing is, you know, there are many aspects of the job that are kind of lonely, if I could put it that way, where it really is you that has to make the call. And often it's between two bad options rather than a good option and a bad option. But it's also important to create an environment in which you're making decisions collectively. You're working as part of a team. And in my experience, the best universities have very strong cultures of distributed leadership in that sense. And I think really university presidents who I've really admired and learned from have been able to get that balance right between giving people a sense of empowerment and allowing those who are closest to the action to make the decisions in the best interest of the organization, but then also knowing when to step in and say, look, no, this is the direction we need to go in, which means we need to make this call and this is the way it's going to go. So I think for me, the first thing is you're building a good team. You're investing in that distributed leadership model, but then you're crystal clear about your role and the unavoidability of having to sometimes make a decision that will be deeply unpopular, but you feel is the right one for the organization. You know, there are moments when nobody wants to make the call because it's too hard, too painful, too difficult. And that's you've got to take on that responsibility. You can't sort of chuck it over to a committee, you know. But if you get it right, you're in a dialogue with people about the organization. You've got the information and inputs that enable you to make the best possible decision in the circumstances.
Well, and you've got a vast lived experience and breadth of different roles that you bring to the table as well, which I'm sure has helped you as you go into your tool chest.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, it does really help me to know what it's like to be a dean or a head of school. And that's something I often try and get other colleagues who maybe haven't been in those roles to just pause and reflect on. You know, I know what it's like to sit in an executive meeting, a decision be made that you weren't in support of and that you know your colleagues will hate, but then have to go back to that community and say, this is what we're doing, and I support it for these reasons. Like, I know what that feels like, you know. And so I know what it feels like when you're trying to get something done as a head of school or whatever, and it just seems like there's this vast bureaucracy leaning over the, weighing on top of you. So, you know, you can't necessarily solve that, but you can empathize with that and help people understand the situation that often, you know, people find themselves in those roles. And like I said, what I mean by distributed leadership in a university is all those roles, you know, the heads of department, the head of a team, the head of a student hub, you know, right through to a dean and a vice president. Great universities get that culture as right as you can. They all feel they've got a stake in the organization. They feel that they contribute. And even when decision doesn't go their way, they feel, hey, you know, I'm still part of this discussion. I'm still part of the leadership team, and I'm still going to want to contribute.
Well, it comes back into, I guess, in some ways, you know, getting that alignment, I guess, you know, from everyone and when possible and nudging that, I guess, your role is probably, as someone described another VC, you know, in an English institution described it as you're a little bit like a nudger in chief too.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, I steal that. Yeah, I mean, I'm big though on strategy. I mean, that's really fundamental to me. And for me, that's one of the core roles as the president and vice chancellor, not only of the university, but I'm sure it's true of other organizations. You got to have, human beings are purposive creatures. They're oriented towards the good. They want to be part of an organization that has a clear sense of direction. And where universities in particular really start to get into trouble is when they drift, when there isn't a sense of direction. There isn't a sense of clear kind of set of priorities, strategic direction. And so I'm really big on that. I'm hot on that. And I invest a lot of time and energy in that. And I want people throughout the whole organization, not necessarily to differing levels of enthusiasm and detail, to feel that they can locate themselves in the future of the institution. That's really important to me. And so I tend to really maybe over-index, if that's the right phrase, on strategy.
Yeah, and the way I'm hearing it as well, it's strategy, but it's also in some ways it's a story, it's a narrative, a compelling narrative and vision for the future, right?
So important, yeah.
Yeah, very, very, you know, interesting. I think these days especially, you know, you need that, as you say, it's something to focus on to actually, you know, move towards a little bit of a guiding light in some ways.
Absolutely, it's important. And then you need to give people a way of articulating that vision for themselves in their own words, in their own language. You know, I spend a lot of, one reason I like doing a lot of visits, town halls, conversations, and try and be very present on the campus is, yeah, to listen to people and give them a chance to ask questions and try and find a way to kind of align with the strategy to the best of their ability and to challenge it too. And because that makes us, criticism makes us better. So that's really important to me.
Yeah, it sort of relates to, I think, what I may have shared with you before about Merrick Gertler, who said that a big part of his role was actually doing exploratory conversations and being out there and gathering that information and bringing it back and weaving it together to I guess, create that strategy.
Exactly. I think we're very similar in that regard. And, you know, the strategy process we put in place here was all about doing that. Creating lots of opportunities in a very structured way, in a very focused way, but giving the whole community a chance to engage. But then being out there and listening and learning and then bringing that back and then playing it back to the community in a way that captured what we felt was the ambition being articulated by our community in a myriad of different ways.
And anchoring it in purpose, too. I love that. You said that I think the individual purpose and also the institutional purpose are so important to consider as well. So, Well, a few minutes left, and maybe I'll ask you a question about if you could provide some advice and wisdom with someone who's maybe coming in from the outside and sort of looking at a leadership role in one of these, you know, messy institutions. What advice would you, extra advice, or maybe a synthesis of some of the advice you've already provided?
What I've learned, and I think people often don't realize, is how intellectually interesting the challenges are that you're presented with in these roles. Sure, there are some really just tough, hard things, difficult, messy things, but trying to figure out how the role of AI in an institution like this is a fascinating, tough problem that is really interesting to get stuck into. Thinking about the kind of curriculum, the kind of education that the young people coming to us really need and should have. First of all, it's an unbelievable privilege, like, wow, to shape literally tens of thousands of young people's experience, and not just young people, people of all ages. But that's a really deep, hard, complex problem. You know, deciding, you know, the direction of an institution like this when you know it'll have very significant impact on the local community and tens of thousands of people who, you know, work at the university, et cetera. These are really interesting, big problems, right? So I think sometimes when people say, oh, God, why would I do one of these roles? What I'll say sometimes is, look, yeah, there's some really hard, sometimes unpleasant aspects to it, but you get to work on really hard stuff that matters, you know? And I think that's something we underestimate. And I didn't really appreciate until I got stuck into these roles. And I was not someone who woke up every day dreaming of being a vice chancellor. I can tell you that. I mean, it's completely random that I'm here, seriously. And the only other thing I'd say in terms of practical advice, it was certainly something that I got from a number of mentors and people who were incredibly generous to me, is be ready for the opportunity and don't say no just because you don't know what might happen. And that's, you know, not everyone is comfortable doing that, but it turned out that I had a slightly insane degree of risk appetite when it came to my personal decision-making. And I have a wonderful supportive partner and family who, you know, have been part of it all along the way. So yeah, I think being ready for the opportunity, you know, learning and always seeking out opportunities to learn and grow.
Well, it actually reminds me of another philosopher, perhaps, actually, and that's Levi Strauss as well, who talks about the need for bricolage and being a bricoleur as well, and, you know, trying to test out new things and sort of appreciate them as well along the way.
Yeah, yeah. No, like I said, I'm an inherently sort of curious person, so I think I've always been open to new experiences, new ideas, new challenges, and that's served me well. Having said that, you know, I've gotten a lot of things wrong. There's been some very tough moments. There are days where you go, why am I doing this? And there's a lot of failure and frustration and exasperation that comes with these roles as well. And, you know, you are kind of at the mercy of a lot of things that are not in your control at all. And you have to be kind of willing to accept that. So it's not for the faint-hearted, that's for sure.
No, you're right. But I think, you know, looking back on your approach, your career, you've taken risks, but I think, you know, on the whole, they seem to have paid off. So
yeah, I know, jinx it. Yeah, there's always time for a colossal failure to emerge. Yeah.
Now, if you could go back in time and talk to a young Duncan Iveson, maybe in just before he's going into McGill, actually, would you provide any advice, do you think, to him?
I think the advice would be something like, you know, what I just said. Don't say no just because you don't know. And just hold the opportunity open long enough to maybe jump off the cliff or jump through the window, whatever the appropriate metaphor is. Yeah, don't say no just because you don't know. As a young person, sometimes you're really anxious about that. And I guess that's what I'd say to my younger self if I
Well, I think that's good advice, and I think it's advice that you probably, you know, instinctively, you know, followed throughout your career anyway.
So, probably, yeah.
You have jumped into a whole bunch of different new, you know, experiences. And thanks so much. This has been a great conversation, Duncan. Really appreciate it, and love your insights on the mess of leadership, but also about, you know, AI and how a complex institution like the University of Manchester is adapting with it too.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's been a surprisingly enjoyable conversation. I don't like talking about myself too much, but I really appreciate your questions. It's been really interesting.
One of the things that stayed with me from this conversation with Duncan Iveson is his willingness to lean into discomfort rather than retreat from it, and how that is anchored in his philosophy background. Throughout the discussion, Duncan talked about the importance of institutions remaining relevant in a world being rapidly reshaped by technology, politics, and changing public expectations. And one of the clearest examples of that is the University of Manchester's embrace of artificial intelligence. It's not because AI is simple, and certainly not because it isn't disruptive. It is disruptive. It challenges assumptions about teaching, learning, assessment, creativity, expertise, and even what it means to know something. For many people inside universities, that creates an understandable anxiety and resistance. But what I heard from Duncan was a recognition that pretending these changes aren't happening is not leadership. Universities have a responsibility to engage with these technologies openly, critically, and thoughtfully, and to bring their communities along through dialogue, transparency, experimentation, and shared learning. That feels deeply connected to another theme that's emerged from our conversation: the continuing importance of philosophy and the humanities in an AI-mediated world. As AI becomes better at generating information, summarizing knowledge, and automating routine cognitive tasks, deeply human capacities may become even more important. Critical thinking, ethical reasoning, interpretation, judgment, reflection, and the ability to wrestle with ambiguity and meaning. In some ways, the future may demand not less philosophy, but more. And perhaps that's one of the greatest opportunities for universities right now, not simply teaching people how to use new technologies, but helping society think more carefully about what kind of future we actually want to build with them. As always, thanks for listening to Messy. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you'll share it with others. The mess is always easier with others.